2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Welcome to another episode of Relentlessly Resilient, where real people share their real life experiences and the tools they've developed to move forward and live their best life. I'm Michelle Scharf.
And I am Jenny Taylor. And today we are here with my friend Julie. Hi, Julie.
Hello, ladies.
All right. Julie is going to tell us her story. She is another widow. Welcome to the Widows Club, the cool club nobody wants to belong to.
Yeah.
But she's also got a unique, she's also got a couple of unique side stories that I'm going to let her get into about her husband's chronic illness and then her journey with adoption for her three children. So she's got, like, we could go on for hours and hours with different angles here. But Julie, we're going to let you take the lead. And can you give us a little background into you and Gary and your family's life?
Yeah, so I met Gary, oh goodness, it's been just a little over 20 years ago now. And from the very beginning, when I first met him, he had always had health issues. So when he was 15, he was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And that was back in the 80s when that was, you know, a really big deal. It tended to be somewhat of a death sentence back in that time frame. And so he underwent some pretty serious treatments, chemo and radiation, and it was kind of the big gnarly stuff back then. And so he came through that first round and did well for about a year and a half. And then he actually relapsed and went through everything all over again.
Wow.
And so by the time, yeah. So by the time I met him, he had recovered from the cancer. And I say that because anybody who's had cancer knows that you never really recover from cancer, right?
Sure.
You figure out how to live with it and the side effects. And so he had some pretty major side effects. Like, he only had one functioning lung, and we always laughed, he was missing so many body parts. It was hilarious. He didn't have like a spleen and part of his lung. And anyway,
did I mention Julie has a fabulous sense of humor?
I learned it from Gary, because he could laugh about it, which made it so that it was okay if I laughed too, you know?
So yeah, how old were you when you met? So how many years after that first diagnosis when you came into his life?
So I was in my early 20s, so I was pretty young, and Gary's a little bit older than me, so he had a little bit more experience in life than I did.
Okay.
Which was kind of a sweet combination, because he was a little, he'd been around the block a few times, and I was kind of wide-eyed and Pollyanna about the whole thing, which, you know, made it so he could survive a little bit, because I wasn't already terrified because of all the history.
Okay, right. Yeah, you came into it new.
Yeah. And so when I met Gary, it was so funny. He always said he was the healthiest sick person you'd ever meet.
Oh,
because unless you knew that he was sick, you would never know, except that he was pretty skinny all of his life. But he would go through bouts of, you know, like major hospital stays. And those were always complications from the cancers. And then, 2 weeks later, he'd be rock climbing or fishing on the river. He loved life and loved adventure. So if he wasn't in a hospital bed or at home recovering, he was out doing something.
Why is it always these guys that are the ones that get the cancer?
Michelle's husband was a lot like that. Very active, and he ended up dying from cancer. But you couldn't keep him down no matter how hard you tried.
Don't you think it's always the ones that are just like embracing life that are the ones that are taken?
Yeah.
It seems
so wrong. Yeah, like he was trying to cram in his whole lifetime into the few years that he got. And I think he did pretty well. I'm going to be honest with you. He crammed in quite a bit.
He didn't waste a day.
He never wasted the minute of it. No.
So tell us about your journey together when you two get married and have your family, and what things look like maybe that first 5 or 10 years of your married life.
Yeah. So we dated forever because, you know, Gary in his infinite wisdom, because he was older than me, you know, said to me all along, you don't want this. You don't want this life. I am not going to live to be an old man. I can't have kids. You say it's fine now because you're in your 20s, but it's not fine. It's not okay. And for me, almost from the beginning, I met Gary and I loved him. It was ridiculous. I remember I hadn't known him very long and I was driving home from a date. And I remember sitting at a stoplight and thinking to myself, if I don't marry him, I will spend the rest of my life looking for somebody exactly like him.
Wow.
And it never changed for me from that moment on. And so,
a few years down the road, that is real love to me.
That's true love. Yeah. His health issues and things didn't scare you away.
Right. You're willing to, if you knew him. Yeah.
But if you knew him, all of that was so insignificant because being around him, it's like a drug, right? Like I couldn't not, like, even today, he's been gone almost 4 years and he's never out of my thoughts ever. Like he is my person and you really can't separate us. Like there's no such thing as Julie without Gary and Gary without Julie.
That's just
kind of always been our history.
Yeah.
So beautiful. So, I love that he's like, no, we're not going to do this because, you know, I can't have kids and you think it's okay, but it's not okay. And I want so much more for you. What he was saying is, I love you so much. I'm willing to not even have you to give you the things I can't give you.
Yeah.
And that's beautiful.
Right.
That's
beautiful.
That is love. That is real love. That's awesome.
Yeah. He had this, you know, spiritual maturity that went way beyond, you know, the years he had here. So we dated forever, like, especially in Utah terms, we dated for like 4.5 years, which is basically an eternity.
Yeah, that's a really long time around here.
Right?
I didn't even know that was possible here.
Right? Exactly. We're the oddity.
I thought a year was long here.
Uh-huh. Right? So through all of that, he took a job in Idaho, which really hurt my feelings. So I took a job in Arizona, and then we realized that was really stupid. So then I ended up moving to Idaho. Yeah. I remember moving up to Idaho, and we never fought ever, but we kind of had this little tiff one day, and he was just so worried about it, you know, that I was young and that I would regret this life with him. And I remember, like, the one and only time I think I've ever yelled at him, I just said, "You don't get to choose for me. Knock it off."
Yeah.
And then after that, he proposed, and there went our happy ever after. So
yay. It just,
yeah. And then we found out about our first child, Jameson, and his adoption happened so quickly that really, truly, we got married. So we started the adoption process before we were married because we ended up, through a friend of a friend, we were matched with a birth mom. And so literally Gary told everybody we had to get married because we had Jameson 6 months later. I'm like, that's not funny.
Well, and did you mention you've got this cute little black baby and
he's adopted. Obviously he's not the same color and he's perfection. But Gary thought that was so funny. So like once our life started together, it took off like 90 miles an hour. It was so fun. So we ended up adopting over the years, 3 babies who those miracles are my, like, those are my treasured stories. And we'd have to do another podcast about those babies, but we did end up creating a family of 5 of us. So, what else can I tell you? What else do you want to know?
So where do you call home? You and those 3 kids, you and Gary.
Yeah. So right now home is Morgan, Utah, and we'll stay that way as long as I can stay here because I have never met more incredible people in my entire life. And actually the town of Morgan plays into Gary's story really beautifully because he grew up here and everybody knew him as the kid with cancer. And so literally the whole town has prayed for him, watched over him, helped his family. They have embraced, you know, Gary and his family basically as long as Gary's been here. So coming back home to Morgan to raise our kids has created this beautiful place for my kids because, you know, later when Gary was diagnosed, well, A, we stand out because I'm like the only lady with black kids, or I was at the time, right? So sure. It's kind of hard to miss us, let's be honest. I like to joke and say I brought all the diversity to Morgan, which is not true, but
it might be close to true.
We laughed about it. But, you know, from day one, the people here embraced our little family, and we are okay today, mainly because of the people of Morgan.
Well, that's beautiful.
So,
that's beautiful.
Yeah, they're a big part of his story.
All right, Julie, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we want us to tell you what happens next. We know Gary's been sick his whole life, but obviously things must have taken a turn. So hold on and we'll be right back.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America. But this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
All right, Julie, so tell us, what year did you move to Morgan? And then at what time point in your and Gary's life together did things kind of take a turn for the worse, for good?
Yeah, so we, right after we adopted our oldest, just a few months after, actually, he had the opportunity to come. We were living in Idaho at the time, and he had the opportunity to come to Utah, back to Morgan, with the same company. And we were so excited because every time we would come to Morgan and visit his family, you know, that drive up the canyon is just beautiful. And I always said to Gary, if we ever got the chance to go to Morgan, I want to go. And right after we got our oldest, it fell into place and we came home. And he did really well for quite a few years. And then, so that would have been in 2002. And then in 2007, so we had our oldest two boys, and our second boy was like 6 months old. And our oldest and Gary were like wrestling and rolling around on the floor, and he was trying to ride on Gary's back, and Gary grabbed his neck one day and went, "Oh, ow, that hurts." And I said, "What is it?" And he kind of looked at me and he had this funny look on his face, and he's like, "Oh, there's like a knot right there in my neck." And I was like, "Oh, that's weird. Let's keep an eye on it." Anytime a cancer patient says, "Oh, there's a lump right there," you just panic, right?
Yeah.
So we kept an eye on it. And over the course of about a week, it changed from about the size of a pea to like the size of a peanut shell. And this thing was growing fast. Yeah, it might have been a little longer. My concept of time,
sure,
I will be honest,
I
have widow brain
fog. But you're
fog,
not talking so. Months and months. You're talking days.
No, it was
days.
We were talking days. And so we called his oncologist, who at this point was a dear friend because we see him like every few months.
We're on a pretty close basis.
Right. Yeah. Like I can drive to the U in my sleep. So we call his oncologist and he says, "I will see you in the morning." So long story short, we go down and it is a stage 4 sarcoma with basically no survival rate.
Oh my gosh.
But Gary's Gary and he doesn't quit. And he just says, "Well, do what you got to do." So they do a massive right neck dissection where basically they take out the entire right side of your neck. So they took the big surgery, took out everything.
Oh my gosh.
And come to find out that tumor came, it was a secondary cancer from the radiation he'd had as a child. He had actually lived long enough post-radiation to see a secondary cancer. And so he was one of the first, especially in Utah, to survive that initial radiation long enough to see secondary cancer. So
wait a second.
There wasn't enough.
I'm not super familiar with the cancer world. So other people may have also run into that, but a lot of people who undergo that kind of intense radiation therapy don't live long enough for it to be problematic. Okay. I was just making sure I understood.
Exactly.
Because I was going to ask if this was connected to his other cancer. Yeah. So it's not necessarily his other cancer coming back.
It was
back.
The treatment from that
Correct.
Cancer.
The treatment.
Correct.
Oh, my goodness. What year was this?
So those early treatments they used.
What year
for
the next surgery?
So that was 2006, somewhere right in there.
Okay.
So
I have one more question. Well, when you say they took out his neck, are you talking like the muscles,
You'll laugh. We used to joke because he's like, "I have half a neck now, like the skinniest neck you've ever seen." Like I had to have his, So they took out his jugular vein, his muscles, his skin. Like, they took probably
I kind of didn't know you could do that.
The right side of his neck.
Yeah, I didn't know.
I didn't either, actually. I'm
sitting here thinking about what's in our neck, and I'm like, I don't know that
it's
you can take
everything important.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm like, how do you remove any of that? And how
but
do
wait
you
a sec.
Keep
this
your
is,
head up?
This is 2005, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
And then you just said it's almost been 4 years since he passed away. So he lived quite a number of years between the...
You bet he did.
Okay, tell us some more. Tell us some more.
Yeah.
So the only way to treat a radiation-induced cancer was with radiation at the time.
Wow.
Which is a crazy oxymoron, but it was so aggressive and so fast-growing that they had to get it, like, we couldn't even wait for chemo to catch up, right? So he underwent this major surgery, 6 weeks of intensive radiation, and survived it. And, you know, his oncologist said, I don't really know how you're still here. But
like, have you
he
met
did tell
this
us
guy?
At the time,
I know why he's here.
Right. Yeah. He's not going anywhere. He's not done. So he ended up telling us, look, this will cause, like, we know this is going to cause problems later on. We know that the radiation you've had is going to do damage to your heart and lungs. It's just a matter of time. So Gary actually did really well. We ended up adopting our little girl. He worked more than full time. He was educated and beautiful and had an awesome career. He managed nursing home facilities for his whole life and loved it. And he did really, really well until 2014. All of a sudden, he started losing weight. And he, like I told you, he was skinny to begin with, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, he was dropping like a pound a day.
Oh my gosh.
And we knew something was really off. And so, we went in and they were like, oh, we're sure it's another cancer. We couldn't find it anywhere. I mean, we had the best doctor ever. And they finally, what we finally figured out is that he had heart and lung failure because the radiation had just done so much damage to his heart and lungs that they were not functioning anymore. And at that time, they told us that we had between 6 to 12 months left before his heart and lungs wouldn't be able to function anymore. And it came out of nowhere for us.
Wow.
Cause I mean, we've done this all the time, right? Gary gets sick. We go to the hospital. We're like, cut it out, radiate him, do what you got to do. And then
get back to life.
Like,
sure.
Yeah. Like, we've got babies and we've got plans and get out of the way.
Yeah.
So to hear that this, you know, had a time frame attached was just shocking.
Was this the first any of his diagnoses had come with a time span?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And Gary always told his doctors, don't tell me, don't you dare give me a time frame. I will tell you when I'm done.
Oh.
So they were really respectful of that. And nobody ever said, look, you're done. And so, but we knew that the illnesses that he had, like the longest anyone had survived with those types of illnesses and problems was 3 years. And we were pretty sure he was already about a year and a half into
already.
It. He just had lived along for so long.
Sure.
Right. So we came home and had some decisions to make. And I just remember it was the strangest thing, Jenny. It settled on us. And I remember being so offended that this death sentence was like settling on us. And we both knew that this was our path.
Wow.
And, you know, because initially you want to fight back. And I mean, here's Gary, whatever, he's done cancer 3 times. He's like, I'll do it again. You know what I mean? I can handle anything. And somehow this just settled on us. And
how old
we
were the
decided,
kids? How old are the kids at the time of diagnosis?
That's a good question. My brain is going to have to fight to think
know,
this through.
Sorry.
So, yeah, right. I know, right?
Jenny has a habit of asking women telling their stories to
Jenny
do math.
Details?
I know. I'm sorry. I can't remember how old my own kids were when my husband died. But I think
seriously.
Our listeners are they little? They're still little. Are they junior high?
They're little. So
give me a picture.
Like junior high
and
so
upper
like,
elementary.
Yeah, so 8th grade, 7th grade, and then elementary.
Okay.
Or excuse me. 8th, 6th, and elementary. So my little girl is probably like 7.
Okay. I'm
so,
just trying
so
to
So they're little,
them.
But
it's
they're
little.
Big enough to know what's going on.
And
like,
they've been
these
through
boys
it before. I
are
mean,
hearing
honestly,
conversations. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that for a minute. So you make the decision to marry him and accept this life.
Mm-hmm.
Did you really understand what you were getting? Looking back
of
now.
Course not. Who ever knows?
Right. Did you ever think like, okay, I'm not really going to have this guy around for a very long time Or did you just think, no, he's going to beat the odds and I'm not going to worry about this. We're going to have a full life.
Oh, I knew it. I used to, at like every couple of years, I would have this vivid dream of being at his funeral. And I would wake up just like gasping and sobbing because I knew it. I knew that was... And but here, I will tell you this, Michelle.
Here's the truth of the matter. It really doesn't matter whether you know it or not, right?
No.
Right.
No, it's true.
But interesting that you kind of did already know it. I mean, neither of us sitting in this room could say that.
Right. And so two really important things. One, I remember there's only been three things in my life that I have ever been 100% certain about. And I can tell you, number one, that Gary, he's it for me. He is my person. If I didn't marry him, I would have looked for him forever. Number two, that adopting babies was my path in life. That is how I find my people. And I have not for one second regretted that path. That's my awesome. Other like absolute truth. And the third is that I will be okay being Gary's widow. And I cannot tell you how or when that settled on me, but those three things I carry in my pocket every day. And those are absolutely true for me.
Wow. That's beautiful.
And they bring you, it sounds like it brings you a strength and a peace, even though of course you don't necessarily like it. I mean,
Right.
Like you said, so that diagnosis settles on you. You've got decisions to make. What were those decisions? Was it decisions of whether or not to do aggressive treatment? Was it decisions how to spend the last time that you have together? I mean, I can't even think of the list of decisions, but what between that diagnosis and his passing, can you walk us through a little bit of that and some of those bigger decisions or bigger moments?
Yeah, Jenny, it was the most beautiful disaster you've ever seen. Like, beautiful in that Gary. So first of all, I mean, let's go back to Gary's amazing sense of humor. Like, he's hilarious. And we had this incredible privilege of being able to talk about everything. And I mean, everything. I remember crying to him in the car and saying, I can't be at your funeral. And he said, love, the only thing I want at my funeral is for you to speak. That's all I want. I just want you. And I said, fine, then you better speak too. And he said, okay. So that was our deal. He said, the only thing I want at my funeral is for you to speak and I will speak. And I said, okay, then I will do it. And you know, I walked in one day, the living room, and here's my literally dying husband. And I was like, I have the worst headache. It's killing me. And he just started to laugh. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Did you really just say that? That's okay, Julie. It's like sometimes when friends will tell me how hard their week's been because their husband's out of town for a couple of days and they're home alone with all the kids. And I'm like, you did not just say that to me, but that's okay if you just said that to me.
But it's their truth.
I have a headache.
Like, it's their reality.
Yeah. Honey, and I
Jenny,
have such
we talked
a headache.
About,
I love you.
Seriously. But we talked about everything. I mean, everything. We talked about, how do you want to die? Do you want a viewing? What am I supposed to do? We had a little bit of life insurance. What am I supposed to do with it? And Gary, I feel like you do know Gary, but I'm like, you know, Gary, he was like, dude, I'm going out with a bucket list. And we had so much fun with his bucket list because friends got involved and they like, we had some really dear friends, like gather us up, take us to Colorado, sit on the 15th row at a Broncos game.
Oh,
Gary's team. Right.
I love it.
And you could hear Peyton Manning yelling, right? You could see the blood. And I mean, it was like so fun.
So you and were able to fill those last months with beautiful moments and memories.
Oh my gosh.
I love that.
So every day, Gary and I had a deal. Towards the end, he was so sick that he was on oxygen in a wheelchair. It was really hard for him to get out. But I said, you're not going to sit down in this basement and die alone. Every day we go outside. And we went on a date every single day. And we were so poor. We were so broke. He wasn't working, you know.
Yeah.
But sometimes I would scrounge up like $2.50 and I'd get him in the car. And it took hours to get him medicated to the point where you could get in the car, right? I'd gather him up and I'd put him in the car and we'd go to 7-Eleven and we would buy a big Diet Coke and a thing of nachos. And we would actually drive up to the cemetery because in Morgan, it is the most beautiful spot. And we'd sit up there and I'd try to coax him into eating nachos and we would just talk about everything. He would say, this is how I'm going to come back and help you after I'm gone. This is how we're going to parent the kids. He was like, I want you to buy the car that you want. I'm such a clothes horse, like that's my love language, sweaters, right? So we would laugh and he would say, I want you to take a few hundred dollars for the life insurance and just go buy some pretty things. And I'd laugh and say, I don't need that. And he's like, I don't care. That's what I want to give my wife.
Yeah.
And we had this beautiful opportunity to say it all.
Wow.
And some of it was devastating and hard, but those conversations I carry with me because I don't have to wonder, what does Gary want me to do? What would Gary say about this? Because he was so brave. I can't imagine being in his spot and being the one that was leaving.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could have said it, but he said it all. You know, there's love notes in my journals. There's letters for the kids. We said and did all of it, which is the excruciatingly beautiful part of knowing that you're leaving, right?
Yeah.
And he was so brave, and we said it and we did it, and he told his friends, and oh my gosh, that was the other part that was the best. The people that came into our home and just loved him, because you could laugh about it. You know, towards the end, Gary's 6 feet tall, and I think he maybe weighed 120 pounds,
oh
right?
Oh my gosh.
He looked gaunt and, you know, and so his old shirts were hilarious. They were way too big. And his best friend shows up at the door one day to visit him. And he looks at Gary, and it's probably a little shocking for him. And Gary's standing there kind of ready for a fight, right? Like, I dare you to insult me. And his friend says, dude, I think you need a bigger shirt. And they just cracked up.
I love it.
He loaded him in his car and took him for a drive. And the people that showed up to love him and buffer that, it was like heaven was in our home, because all of these amazing people came and said, I loved you and loved our kids. And, you know, here's all my kids watching this happen. And they're seeing that dad is leaving, and in their little minds, they understand it to the ability that they're able to.
Sure.
And they're going, oh, this is what it means that you're loved and you're watched over, and people come and take care of you, and mom and dad hang on to each other for dear life. And I kind of think that my kids got to see what a love story looks like front row.
Yeah.
You know, I remember walking in the kitchen and just, Gary would be at the table trying to eat, and I'd walk up behind him and I would kiss him on the side of his face, and I would say, you just stay here, okay? And he would say, I'll try. And I'd say, that's enough. Then I'd make dinner. And just this constant open conversation was this tender buffer. And it was excruciating, but it made it so soft that I could live there and Gary could live there in that place. Because you can't really wrap your head around the fact that one of you is dying,
but not today.
It is the most surreal thing I've ever lived.
Julie, I love how you called it the most beautiful disaster. I mean, is that not exactly this oh, is totally so was. Beautiful, and yet it's a terrible disaster and a tragedy and a heartache and devastation. Yeah. We're going to take one more quick break and come back. I hear in your voice an amazing sense of positivity, humor, light, hope. And yet you're acknowledging the fact that this is devastating. Let's come back and have you teach us a little bit of what you know of resilience and how you've been able to see the beauty even in the middle of your disaster. All right, Julie, you've given us such an insight into your beautiful love story, a love story that continues. Can you talk to us about resilience, what that has looked like, what it's felt like, what the fight for you has been to keep such a positive, humorous approach to something that didn't just come on you for a few months, but for the entire time you knew your husband? Teach us, because you've got so much I know the rest of us need to learn.
So a day or two after we buried Gary, I came up to his grave, and I remember sitting there and having this overwhelming understanding that because of Gary's life and how he chose to die, I had had a front row seat on how to do hard things gracefully. And I remember thinking, it's my turn now, because the whole time Gary was sick, really, I just stood by him and he did the hard thing. And I remember thinking, it's my turn now. And I understood in that moment that my widowhood was now my calling in mortality. This is my job. And if this is my job, then I want to do it the very best that I am able to. If I'm going to be a widowed mother, then I'm going to be the best widowed mom that I know how to be. And that was the beginning, that decision that this wasn't going to ruin me kind of was that foundation of where to go from here. Not that I had any idea, let's be honest, but well, I kind of had this, like, this is how I want this to go, right? Mm-hmm. And really a lot of that came into place when I met my widow friends. I have this group of about five or six amazing younger widows that they started telling me how they've survived it and what did it look like for them. And every time we would sit down and talk, they would say out loud these truths, like these things that came out of their mouth. And I'm like, that is true. That is true for me. And I would put it in my pocket and I would take it home with me and I would mull it over. And I started this list that I call my widow truths. And I have it in my phone, so it's always with me. And it's things that I have learned that I incorporate into my daily survival. And it's everything from death ends a life, not a relationship. I choose to create a peaceful widowhood. I don't just believe in miracles. I rely on them. My marriage didn't go anywhere. I mean, I have all of these little things that
keep going,
that I carry
keep going.
With me. Right? I know.
I love all of these. I love all of these. I've seen a bunch of them on memes on widow groups, and and I collect them. I collect them.
Right?
I love that.
You have to as a widow.
I love the first one that you said, death ends
a life.
A life, not a relationship.
Life. Isn't that awesome?
I don't think people really understand, like, you really can still grow that relationship. I have the strangest thing that happened last night. I'm just going to share the story with you.
Oh, tell me. Oh, I love these.
So I ate a piece of chocolate, one of those, the foil wrapped Hershey's, like the little nuggets, the nuggets.
Uh-huh. Gotcha. Okay.
Okay. So, you know, it has that foil that's heavy, and I placed it next to my bed, and I have a little fan running in my room that's also next to my bed, but I placed it next to my bed. And about 20 minutes later, it starts rocking back and forth loudly. And I'm like, what is that? And I turn over and I see this wrapper rocking. And I'm like, well, that's strange because it's pretty loud and it's moving quickly.
It's a piece of tinfoil. Mm-hmm.
Right. It's a piece of, right. But I thought it was strange because I'm like, I didn't just turn on the fan. Like, why did it just start doing
that?
Right,
right. Why now?
So I looked at it and I said, John, is this you? If this is you, make it stop. And it stopped.
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, John, are you making this thing go? Make it go. And it started rocking again.
Oh.
And I'm like, I believe those things happen. I believe that there are signs all around us. It's just whether we'll choose to acknowledge them and see them.
Michelle, we call those our postcards from heaven. And if you look, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Because I always say, Gary's greatest joy, I know this, when he sends something to me and I see it, he's like, I knew my wife would get that. And that is how we stay in love, right?
Yeah.
We have those little moments all the time. And it's him, it's his way of texting me and saying, I love you. And I'm like, I know. I see you. I tell him that all the time. I see you, Gary.
Yeah. I would love to have an offline discussion because I have a bunch of things that we could talk about. I feel like you really can continue to grow that relationship. And I actually would be okay to find somebody else to finish life with, but I'm starting to get to the point where like, I think I'm done with this looking. And I think I just need to accept that it's me.
Mm-hmm.
It's me for, you know, my kids are all grown, so I don't have kids at home to keep me busy, but I'm like, you know, I think I just got to get on with doing what I want to do and living life.
Which is such a beautiful widow truth. Like, you have to find your path, the thing that works for you.
I love that you said, Julie, back up to what you said, I choose to live a peaceful widowhood, or how did you word that?
Yeah. And I choose to create a peaceful widowhood.
Okay, we could dissect that because for one thing, you're acknowledging that it's a choice. And I really think resilience is a choice. I know some people think it's like this God-given gift, which, okay, it is that too. Or like some people.
Always. It's a muscle to use and exercise.
An exercise, that resilience. So you're creating, and I love that the word you're choosing to create is peaceful. Mm-hmm. Not euphoric, not super fun all the time, not exactly what I always ever wanted. But that you can be at peace. Like you said, when that diagnosis of Gary settled on you, That didn't mean you necessarily loved it or chose it or that's what you'd always dreamed of. And yet you found a peace. And so we can choose to create peace in our lives. Is that not what the world needs right now? We're in a pandemic.
Right.
We're in a time of all kinds of political strife. We've got lots of problems in this world. Heartache that's personal, professional, political. And yet you're teaching us how to create, to choose, to create peace. Let's put that on a t-shirt. I choose to create peace.
Well, and here's the truth of the matter is we all say that we want world peace, but we actually don't. And the proof is we don't have it because, like Gandhi said, be the change you want to see in the world. Be the change. Mm-hmm. If we all wanted peace, we'd all create peace, which means we have to have peace within our own hearts, with our own selves. Mm-hmm. But we also have to choose to not be in conflict with others.
Mm-hmm. To create that peace.
To create it.
And it's proactive. It takes energy and effort.
It takes effort. It takes energy. And it takes resolution. It's not easy, right?
Yeah. I love what Michelle just said about we choose that. So one of the beautiful things that one of the other widows taught me was everybody is going to come to you, especially when you're newly widowed, and they want so badly to fix it for you, right? They want to help you. They want to make it better, and none of them can. And so sometimes people will say or do things that are cliche or trite or just plain unhelpful. And they're not trying to be anything other than wonderful and a relief to you. But one of the things that I was taught that was so beautiful is when somebody hands you something and it doesn't fit, you hand them back one of your truths. When they say, you know, Gary lives on in your heart, I say, no, Gary lives at my right shoulder and he's got a wicked sense of humor, right?
you hand
back these beautiful truths. And the thing that I've learned is that people who are unfamiliar with death, especially the death of a spouse, those things that I've been given to understand, they are so valuable to the people. If I'm willing to open my mouth and share them, most people are like, holy cow, I had no idea. You can still be madly in love with somebody dead. You can.
You can still find meaning and purpose in a widowhood life.
Yes.
Well, and you can still raise your children feeling connected to their father and influenced by him and even disciplined by him. I mean, one of our guests, you know, Courtney, she was one that said, you know, her husband had told her if I'm for some reason ever not here with the kids, go ask your mother. She knows what I would say. You know what Gary would say to those kids in a time of sadness or a time of discipline or something. You can represent him. Mm-hmm. In life. Mm-hmm. Julie, I just love that. I love this beautiful love story of yours that continues. I love your outlook on life and how you've chosen to create a peaceful life in the midst of what a lot of people really could justifiably complain about or just give up and say, that's it. I'm done. No more. I've had enough. And yet time and time again, you've chosen to create a peaceful path. And I'm going to write that down. I'm probably going to put it like on my bathroom mirror. I choose to create a peaceful widowhood, a peaceful motherhood, a peaceful profession, a peaceful whatever it is, and then emphasizing that choice and that grace that you give other people when they maybe say dumb things that aren't helpful, and then you don't just let them say their dumb thing and you don't get mad, but you teach them.
Mm-hmm.
You reply with kind of maybe a clarification that they hadn't thought of. And now your perspective is enhancing their perspective and helping them create peace. I mean, it's just so beautiful.
Well, and it's part of the reason Jenny and I are doing this podcast in and of itself.
I mean,
you know, it is the entire purpose. I think it's, number one, a great avenue to give people a way to document their story and what they've endured. And I feel like we all should have our moment to document, like, this thing was hard. It gives other people the opportunity to say, oh, I'm in a similar situation. There's going to be some stories that are similar that someone can identify with, and it's going to encourage them to move on and move forward. But I also feel like the education piece is really important because it is interesting. It's kind of like you get a brand new car and you're like, oh, I love this color blue. I've not seen this color blue on the road. But then all of a sudden you buy the car and then all of a sudden you're like, wow, there's a lot of the same.
Everybody has a blue car.
Like what was I thinking? I never noticed all of the blue cars before. I think it's the same thing. Like, my sister actually has been a widow for a long time, but I didn't really know a lot of widows, and I kind of felt like that was a rarity. Mm-hmm. And I became a widow, and all of a sudden, I'm the one that people say, oh, this lady just lost her husband in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. This person.
We call it being like the beloved Grim Reaper.
Right.
Like, nobody knows what to do with death until
and it's like,
somebody
dies,
and they're like, what do you do? Oh, you can call Julie or Jenny or Michelle because they'll know what to say.
Right. Because they know. They know what to say or not say. And you know, I always tell people, you know, it's really nothing that you're going to say. You can't say anything to make it better.
No, you can't fix
it. But you can put your arm around them. You can do their dishes. You can bring them a food. And they will get the message that you care.
That you just are that there. They are
just loved, there. And that they are supported. And that's all we need. We just need to know that we're loved. We're still we're still loved by somebody else. The person that loved us the most is gone, but there are going to be others that will take a part and share their love with us. And that means so much.
Yeah, it really
that
does.
Makes me think of one of my other like widowhood truths is that I always joke and say I do widowhood with every advantage possible, because anytime you're in a hard situation, the minute you look around and you start counting blessings, you don't have to look very far. Even things like, we live in a country where like Social Security death benefits are a thing. That's ridiculous. What a huge blessing for me and my kids. I live in a community where when I don't have my crap together and I forget it's high school registration, the coach registered my kids. It's fine. He's got it. I live in an area where, like I said, I have, okay, it's 2021. I'm raising black teenagers in 2021. Are you kidding me? Like, could this be more complicated?
Yeah.
And yet everyone around me loves and looks out for my kids.
Yeah.
If I don't stop and acknowledge every blessing and advantage that I have been given to do this calling that I've been called to, I would ruin it. And so the gratitude, even in the hard stuff, it blunts those sharp edges and it blurs it bearable, because Gary would never leave me to do this by myself. And in fact, I always joke and say, before Gary died, he handpicked the most amazing people to be his friends. And then he left them all to me like this gift, right? Like, I've got the brother that helps with finances and the brother that fixes the car and the brother that comes and takes my boys hunting and he left me these beautiful people, all of which, let's be honest, were drawn to us because of Gary, but I get to keep them. And they are my greatest treasures. These people that Gary chose for us.
Wow.
And so to say that I do widowhood is kind of feels like a misrepresentation, a little bit of a lie. I feel like I have all of these blessings and it's hard. Like, I'm still the lady that cries when her car breaks down because I don't know what to do. But everywhere I look, there's help. There's, you know, there's a tender mercy. There's a miracle. I bump into Gary or a love note he left me, or somebody shows up at the moment. Like, I have this sweet friend, and for some reason she's taken it on herself to every year on our wedding anniversary, she brings me flowers that Gary would bring me.
So sweet.
And every year she softens that day for me. And every year there's beauty in place of ashes.
Yeah,
and
that's so,
I think,
beautiful.
Where the resiliency comes from.
Yeah.
Like, that ability to keep going is because I'm constantly traded beauty for ashes over and over and over.
Julie, I love you. Like, you have taught us so much. And I think it just really comes down to what you've said, that you choose to see. Mm-hmm. You choose to see Gary still in your life. You choose to see the good people helping you. You choose to see the blessing or the tender mercy when everything else is really upside down and kind of a mess. Thank you very much. And that beautiful disaster, you choose to see. But you choose to see the beauty. Most of us would just call it a disaster, let's be honest. I call mine a train wreck all the time. Like, we are such a train wreck. I'm going to start calling us a beautiful train wreck.
Right?
We are a beautiful train wreck at our house. Julie, Julie, I love you. I want what? Here's what I want you to do. I want you to email me.
I call your house a beautiful chaos.
I just call us a family circus. You should have seen us. At the time of recording, we just spent a week at Universal Studios. Me and 7 children, ages 3 to 15. Like, it was the trip of my life. And I'm like, okay, good. We'll never have to do that again. But it was so much fun. Here's what I want you to do, Julie. Can you email me more of those widow truths? And when we post this episode on our social media pages, we'll share some of those. Because I think those concepts are known to a lot of us who've been through hard things, but you've put them into just small words, and that is helpful.
Yeah.
And so we
and I will
thank
give credit
you.
To the widows I stole them from, let's be honest.
And none of us are going to remember where they came from anyway.
It doesn't matter.
Right?
So it's all a blur.
I love that you see the other people in your life and the people that he left you, that it's connection. And that's connection. Especially all of this pandemic in the last year that we've been in. I don't have as many people in my life as what it sounds like you do, but connection is so important. And without the people that I have had come into my life since losing my spouse, no way could I make it through. No way do I make it one day.
It takes a lot of people to fill that hole. Yeah. I always say it takes like 15 people to make one Gary for me.
I've never thought about what it would take to make up a John, but
it takes a lot of people.
It would
really
take a lot.
People, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was just such a, you know, people that knew us well, and one of his good friends would say to me, "Michelle, you're never going to get remarried because there's never going to be any. There's John was one of a kind. There's not another John.
Right. You and can't redo that."
Here's the thing. I could never replace him, and I wouldn't want to.
Right.
John was unique,
right,
and that was special in its own way. But I wouldn't even want to necessarily be with someone that even really remotely reminded me of him in some ways.
Yeah, they have to be pretty different, don't you think?
Yes. Because, because I would need it to be separate from that experience. You know, I wouldn't want to feel like I was making a replacement, because I want to keep what I had whole and special.
And I think for those who have remarried, I think they would probably say that's what they've found, is it's not necessarily a replacement. It's an additional love.
Yeah.
I'm not there in my mind, I'll be honest right now. But, you know, for example, my mother.
Jenny's never going to get remarried. Yeah. She's made that very clear to me.
Yeah.
And tells me I'm crazy all the time for even considering it. I actually think that I'm
starting to agree with me, so I'll just tell you that right there.
She's converting you.
She's converted me, and so has dating.
Dating's what's okay, let's be honest, Michelle. Your dating experience has confirmed my stance against dating. So we'll just stop right there.
It's true.
All right, Julie, we love you. We're excited to share this episode with our listeners. And to our listeners, we thank you for joining us again today. We hope that you're with us every week as we launch a new episode. And what we really hope is that you'll reach out to us and share your stories. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Relentlessly Resilient Podcast. Let us know the real life stories that you have faced, or maybe a family or a friend, a family member, or friend that you know. Help us get these stories out there so that we can uplift, we can inspire each other, and most of all, we can know we are never alone in the hard things that we face. So we're grateful that you're with us. Find us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a rating and a review. And we'll see you next week on the next episode of Relentlessly Resilient.
Thank you for joining us today. And remember, whatever you do, remember to be kind. You have no idea the struggles other people are dealing with in their own lives.